This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
The good news is that AI can and will fundamentally change this equation. It's more than just a technological tool, it's an economic accelerant. This is a Gutenberg moment. Countries mastering AI won't just participate in the future economy, they will shape it. By harnessing the power of AI and other technologies, we can enhance our productivity, we can create new jobs, and secure our economic future.
Earlier this month, the government quietly released a What We Heard report discussing the response to its 30-day sprint artificial intelligence consultation that ran last October. The consultation was promoted as giving Canadians, including a 28-person expert advisory board, the chance to provide their views on AI as AI Minister Evan Solomon works toward a national AI strategy. Consultation garnered some criticism, both for its speed and missing perspectives on the expert panel, and more recently on the use of AI to assess the results, which sparked further doubts about it. Jackson Kahn is the CEO and founder of Aperture AI and a senior fellow at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto. But before that, he served as senior policy advisor to the Minister of Innovation, Science and Industry, where AI was one of his lead responsibilities. He joins me on the podcast to provide an insider perspective on AI policy development in Canada, along with his thoughts on the AI consultation and its results. Jackson, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Michael. Great to be here with you.
Yeah, really glad you joined. You know, I want to get into the government's AI consultation and its broader strategy. That'll be really the focus of our discussion. But, you know, before we do, your experience within government provides, I think, a truly unique perspective on developing and implementing policy in this space. Can you describe a bit your work in Ottawa before you returned to Toronto and the private sector?
Yeah, of course. And Michael, thanks again. It's been great to connect. I really enjoyed having our chats from time to time when we were both in Ottawa together. And so I'll share for the audience, I joined Ottawa from the tech sector. I used to work in a multitude of startups in Toronto, and then I had an opportunity to join the Office of the Minister of Innovation, Science and Industry as a policy advisor, where I focused primarily on artificial intelligence policy, as well as some other tech work, including in quantum computing and semiconductors. And I had a broader remit around, you know, innovation policy, including shred credits, innovation organizations, clusters, all sorts of different things. But one of the things that was cool about the role was not only was I able to get into the investment work, and kind of one of my favorite projects was the $2.4 billion AI Sovereign Compute Fund, but also on the regulation side. With the Bill C-27, privacy modernization, the first AI bill proposed in the history of the country, and also some work on the Competition Act, where I was the senior policy advisor for what was, I think, the biggest revision of a reform of competition laws in modern Canadian history. So yeah, super, super exciting job. And I was happy to do a tour of duty in government.
Oh yeah, no, that's great. And certainly those are interesting issues. Just a couple of weeks ago, we talked about competition policy, actually, part of it driven by some of the reforms that you would have worked on. You know, what are some of the reflections that you might have on some of that policy development? I know there's a sense of sometimes tensions between the political side, and you mentioned you were working in a minister's office as opposed to the bureaucrat or the policy side. You worked on the AI legislation. You know, how hard is it to achieve? Did you find consensus, political movement, and what are some of the tensions that you found, if any, that might exist between the politics and the policy?
Well, the first off, I would say is that I was humbled when I went to government by just how hard it is. I think sometimes it is easy to, you know, be on the outside. I mean, when I was in the tech ecosystem, I was like, oh, why is this so hard? Why is this not better? And then you go in and you realize that everyone's telling you something different. And a lot of them sound really smart, right? You're getting really strong takes from, you know, a big investor over here saying, oh, I'm having a really hard time doing this. You know, can we tweak the tax rules over here? People who are looking to protect citizen and the rights of all Canadians and residents kind of living in the country, you know, saying, hey, what about surveillance? What about these big businesses that are hurting us? And then you also hear from, you know, folks who work in big business saying, well, listen, we, you know, when the pandemic hits, I mean, listen, we responded. We tried to increase wages. We got money out quickly. Like, I think there's actually a lot of very well-intentioned people, both in and outside the public service. And I think sometimes in the business community, and again, I'm culpable of this. It's like, oh, well, government workers, what are they doing? They're trying to clock out early. They're not working hard enough. They've got big pensions. And the truth was, when I went into public service, I met some of the hardest working, smartest people I ever met. And I was very humbled by that. You asked about some of the tensions. I would say at the same time, the public service, I think, does kind of serve, because they have this institutional knowledge and memory and the setup, they sometimes do serve as a bit of a, I'm not going to say a block, but I'd say challenge function. Politicians, you come in, you have a short period of time, and their staff, sometimes staff are coming from a political background, sometimes from a private sector or another background. In my case, again, it was a private sector background. I wanted to get stuff done quickly. And so sometimes, I'd be going back and forth in the public service. I was like, well, why can't we get this done today or tomorrow or next week, right? Because that was the cycle I was used to working on. And so part of the tension is, the public servants typically are in their job for a career. And the politicians, I mean, on the political side, if people get tired of you, you're out. And I think that fundamental, sense of velocity is where you can get where you get stuck. I would also say, the public servants, I mean, they have a challenge where, and again, they're nonpartisan, but certainly, I mean, no doubt they're individuals, right? They want to get something done. They want to make Canada better. We all do. But them, in some way, like they have a continuity. The public service before I got there had certainly tried many different ways of doing various different things. And so when I came in and, thought I had a wonderful idea, sometimes they'd be like, oh yeah, we did a version of that before. And what I would say is just that ultimately I found that that tension is healthy. I do think, the government's under a lot of pressure right now because probably the most challenging time in Canada's history, modern history. I empathize with everyone on both sides of kind of the political and public service spectrum. But what I would say is that building consensus is possible, but it's sometimes hard. And I found the best work I got done was when I was aligned with the public service. We both were respectful to each other and both kind of gave a little bit. And also, sometimes, I had a colleague, he was a very smart colleague. Sometimes he'd walk in the room and say, it just reminded us, we were talking about groceries or competition, like, what's the price of milk, folks? Like just the grounding factor. And sometimes as well, you leave an empty chair and just always be like, okay, well, we all have our opinions around the room, but what's someone over there? What would they be thinking? Like, what's not being said here? What's the gap, right? Because the truth is, we never know everything, and there's always something that I'm sure we could be doing better. So.
You mentioned how fast things happen. There is this sense that from an AI policy perspective, the world just kind of flipped once sort of ChatGPT kind of appeared on the scene, and suddenly something that people had talked about for many years was tangible and real and just the driving force behind a lot of discussion around things like regulation and business opportunity and the like. From your sense, was the government ready for this, or was it seeking to really address some of these issues, as the proverbial plane is kind of in the air and struggling in some sense to come up with something quickly, given how fast things were moving.
Yeah, of course. I mean, listen, like, so I joined government 2022, which is when ChatGPT, GPT 3.5 came out. Kind of crazy timing. And when I came in, I knew I was going to be getting handed some of the tech files, which I was excited about, and AI was one of them. And I thought, oh, great. And, I've worked in an AI startup. I actually ran my own podcast for a little bit in the past, focused on AI. And I was excited about that. But then everything changed really fast. And when I came in, I knew that there was a privacy modernization bill that I was going to be working on. And what I learned when I came in was there was an also AI component that was involved in that. And I think at the time the government was intending, to be very forward-thinking, as Canada has done in the past by being first on an AI strategy. And I think that was a good thing, right? I think there was a bill that was put together that was meant to be a flexible regulatory framework that could build on the privacy legislation. And I think the primary focus of that was what the minister had asked for, which was algorithmic transparency. And the reason he was inspired to do that was because he met Frances Haugen, the whistleblower from Facebook. And he just thought, okay, well, I don't know if we need to figure out everything, but we need to have some transparency into what's happening from these powerful algorithms that are shaping our society. And that was all the genesis and inspiration for that. And I think at the time that was intended to be forward-looking, future-facing. And then, of course, ChatGPT comes out, everybody's heads get turned on a dime, and the expectations skyrocket of, oh my gosh, what is here? What's coming?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear you say I'll say that. The response, certainly from some in the private community, privacy community, who've been looking for and hoping for privacy reform for some time, and all of a sudden to get this the AI side of it bolted onto the same legislation was, shall we say, somewhat critical. I mean, people had were unsure of what was happening here. How did it feel on the inside? Did you feel like it was a good fit, or were there challenges trying to bring these two very large digital policy issues together in a single bill?
Yeah, listen, like I do think there was still validity and a good intention behind bringing them to the table at the same time. It was, because as you know, Michael, as well, the CPPA, the Consumer Privacy Protection Act, also had some automated decision-making components. How can we, create more explainable measures? How do we make sure that people's sensitive information is protected? And of course, given the data is the prerequisite to pretty much everything on AI, I mean, it's not like there's just a thematic alignment there. It's, hey, like these are directly interlinked to what would we do to one, side of the body here is certainly going to affect the other. So I think I can understand that. At the same time, because everything shifted with AI happening so fast. I mean, again, the bill had already been tabled, then suddenly this happens. Maybe if we could go back in time and we knew the outcome was going to be that we died on the order paper, we would have done things differently. And some many folks had suggested, oh, split the bill or try and push it back. These are all options that certainly, as a policy advisor, you have to present multiple options, right? So it's not like it was never discussed. But if you could go back in time, maybe it would have been good to get the privacy piece done. But then again, like, look, a couple years later, we're also in an entirely new regulatory environment in a way, right? The EU has shifted back. They may water down some of their proposals based on the Draghi report. The US has completely changed their approach. And so if the ultimate goal is how do we make sure that Canada remains economically competitive while also having a good modern privacy regime? And then ultimately, ideally, some guardrails on AI. Like maybe it's good that we took a beat. And also some of the concerns and risks I think about AI have not played out, and others have gotten even worse than maybe expected, right? I think particularly how chatbots are interacting with children right now, for example, or sexually explicit deepfakes. Like, whereas other, concerns about super intelligence, AGI coming soon enough, some of these other risks, though, those seem to be far much further off, right? So that's my quick review on it. I think I don't blame anyone that was involved in the process. I've forgiven myself. I don't know if I'm allowed to do that, but listen, I think there's a lot of well-intentioned people trying to listen to all sides, and the private sector wanted less, and and civil society wanted more. It's a tough bind to be in to try and find consensus in that realm, especially with something that was the hottest topic at the time.
Sure. Okay. Well, I think that bind continues, which provides a pretty good segue to the attempt to develop an AI strategy in the current environment with the new AI minister, Evan Solomon, and in particular, the consultation that was launched last fall, then followed by just over the last number of weeks with a What We Heard report that gives a sense of what the government had to say. Now, that the consultation itself faced a fair amount of criticism. If we go back before we get to what they heard, just to think back at what people were saying at the time, and there was some criticism about how fast it was going. It was described by the minister as a sprint. Some real questions about representation, and there were even some slight adjustments that were made after those came forward. Can you describe a little bit, the two sides of the consultation? There was both the expert side in terms of a committee. There was the public-facing survey side, how it functioned, and having been on the inside, thoughts at how difficult it is to develop one of these kinds of consultations and move, in a sense, as quickly as the government tried to on this issue in particular.
Definitely. Listen, I can start with the good stuff. One off, I mean, there was a broad open public consultation. It was at least at one point open to everyone, right? There's over 10,000 responses. I'm generally in favor of, a public consultation on a big piece of legislation. I was involved in a couple of them. One was on the Competition Act, where there was it was a pretty open consultation period, and the second was on the copyright portion of AI, which was regarding how Gen AI applied to copyright. I think those were good exercises. I think the What We Heard report process is a good one. So at least what feedback was heard by the government. I think I empathize with Minister Solomon, where he came in again, very challenging time in Canada's moment. I think he wanted to come in and do a roadshow, send a lot of positive signals, especially on the industry side, because I think he likely felt like that had been soured by the experience with the ADA portion. As well as the government's been trying to recoup, I would say credibility and trust with the tech sector because a lot of it was lost through the whole capital gains piece that was announced in budget 2024. The statistics on Canadian entrepreneurs and tech companies going and starting a lot more companies in the U.S., that's been like those numbers have gone significantly down. So there are a lot of Canadians who have chosen to build their companies elsewhere. And so I think he sees that given the economic trade crisis we're in is probably priority number one, which fair enough. I would argue that it is, right? Like, again, if we don't have a strong economy, I mean, what are we building on? It does significantly hamper our ability to build public infrastructure and all the other things that we want to do. So the second thing is timeline. Again, I think it's good that they launched a public open consultation. Could they have done 60 days, 90 days? Likely. I don't know if there was a big obstacle to that, but you know, they made a call to do it shorter. I think the expert panel is certainly, I mean, the government's always going to call a blue ribbon panel for these types of things. I think it makes sense. Could the composition have been improved? Certainly. I'm sure it could have. I think that there's probably no way they could have got it to a point where some groups would not have complained or some individuals would not have complained. So I don't think it's an easy exercise. I think one thing I'll name specifically was I had seen a professor post that, you know, there wasn't a single Black individual who was part of the task force. I think that was an easy miss that I think the minister has since publicly acknowledged. And I believe he's done that with kind of some leading figures in the Black policy and technology communities, which I think is a good step. I think, you know, admitting you did something wrong is always a good first step. I think that was an easy miss because number one, we know that Canadians who are Black are almost always from data considered to be some of the most at risk from artificial intelligence systems that might have bias or harm, especially in, let's say, law enforcement, policing, more sensitive. So I think that was an easy, again, an easy miss. I believe there was some more commentary and task force member representing perspectives from more of a First Nations Indigenous background. So I think that was more positive. So was the competition of the task force. I just say third, like on terms of the process, I mean, they gave it a couple months post kind of those submissions. I guess if we take us to February, they released the report. I published some commentary in the report. I know you have as well, Michael. Again, I think publishing a consensus type report after such broad input is hard. I don't envy it. The reason I would focus on, at least from outside, you know, I wanted to dive in. I know you want to dive into, Michael, into the task force reports. I think it's good to evaluate what are the tensions the government is actually considering across the public AI investments. Do you diffuse AI? Do you still have, try to have a, you know, a finger in the pie of frontier AI training and deployment? Do we invest in winners? Do we build out more ecosystem? What do we do on fundamental research versus applied? I mean, these are all like open questions.
I think it's really useful to
Yeah.
talk about some of those issues. You mentioned the report itself, and you've done a couple of posts on it. I've done a couple of posts on it. Why don't we, your post, you know, I think one of the ways that you phrased it was that there were common concerns but different prescriptions for what to do. Can you talk a bit about how that plays out? What are some of the common concerns, and if you like, how where do we see some of the divergence in terms of some of the feedback about what Canada ought to be doing about them?
Yeah, we won't be able to iron out everything, but I'll pick a couple. So one is, I mean, how do we drive innovation in Canada, right? This common diagnosis is we have great talent, some of the best in the world. Literally, the researchers and people invented this stuff. I mean, neural networks, deep learning, transformers, and that's just on AI, right? I mean, we really, really do kick butt at coming up with amazing ideas, but how do we commercialize them? How do we actually make money from this? It seems like we have great Canadian companies that come along, whether in telecommunications, Nortel, BlackBerry, and RIM. Now we have Shopify, right? And I'm talking about companies that are $100 billion plus. And then I'm also thinking about companies that are essential to the ecosystem. Arguably, right now, we don't have any AI companies that are essential to the ecosystem, right? And if you compare that to, yeah, again, smaller countries like Taiwan or the Netherlands, I mean, they have essential, absolutely essential parts of the stack. Right. And if you think about our critical minerals and our talent, our, you know, people, you know, are good at chip design or model development, I mean, the fact that we don't have something as essential to the stack is challenging for us. So the question is, how do we get there? Right. So there could be more industrial research and development. That's something that Gail Murphy talked about. How could we copper, let's say, the Fraunhofer Institutes, IMEC, things like, you know, institutions in Europe that have been more successful at converting good ideas into scalable companies. Second would be, you know, do we look at moonshots, right? Should we really just be focusing on those ideas we really think can produce these kind of 100x, multi-hundred billion dollar opportunities, really own and make sure we own the intellectual property that's in the next phase. So this is a big tension, right? And one of the arguments always is that Canada doesn't do enough to prioritize like IP that we actually own. We just come up with ideas, we give them away. We don't prioritize patenting things. So that's something that comes up. There were also proposals, I'll just say one last thing on the entrepreneurship side, to dramatically reduce the amount of capital gains that entrepreneurs pay because the US, as some people say, has a much more competitive environment for entrepreneurs. So lots of different ideas, ways we could go. Second, I would say, would be on the safety side. So, you have Dr. Taylor Owen coming out and saying, we need online harms legislation. We need to even further improve the privacy modernization piece. This is critical to preserve our democratic institutions. Then you have someone like Joab Pinault, a very, very well-regarded AI researcher, now chief AI officer at Cohere, taking more of a safety reporting transparency approach. And this is just one of, again, the pieces that she highlighted in her task force report, but I do this to highlight some of the tensions. You also had other folks commenting on discrimination as kind of a critical focus. Again, like all of these are likely good things that we can pursue, but can we do them all at once? And do some of them, are they mutually exclusive of others? The last third thing I would say is adoption and diffusion. So the question is not just how do we create these innovations, but how do we spread them across our society? Do we even want to spread them across our society in some parts, right? And so you had people talking about how can we do that through better investment in infrastructure, maybe public AI infrastructure that can be shared. Can you have AI adoption programs, especially helping small businesses? These are all things that are important. I think the government, I posed this question towards the end of my analysis. I was like, let's say, we can do a couple pieces of legislation. We have $5 billion to spend over the next few years. What do we focus on, right? And who's got the best evidence? And I don't envy the people who have to make those decisions. But these are like these questions, I imagine, even when the AI task force or the AI strategy is announced, will not be fully finalized. They will continue to be active discussion. I think it's kind of on folks in the private sector and civil society to continue to engage, talk to government, but also hold them accountable for the outcomes that you think are important.
Okay. I mean that's a really good summary of a whole lot of issues there. I mean, and I know there's more, but I think that's
Do my
great.
best.
Yeah, no, it's really good. I think it highlights how within each of those issues, you identified a whole series of different kinds of policy choices and different things that could be prioritized, and we'll have to see how that happens. It is striking that sort of at the next level up, almost at more at a meta level. I know that in one of your posts, you identified some of the key issues more broadly, and sort of the government has these various policy pillars. There's a whole series of them. I guess it raises the question, within each pillar, there is a question of, what do you prioritize? But I guess I'm curious about your thoughts about which of the pillars is most important. What are the issues that we have to focus on most predominantly? I mean, perhaps it's the three that you just mentioned, that's why you picked them. Or maybe there's something else. But one of the risks that I do worry about is that, if everything is that if there's an effort regularly to try to fit everything in within these various pillars that works very nicely in sort of this policy framing, do you end up with any priorities at all if you're trying to do something along all of these different lines?
Listen, if I had to pick one, and I think this is mutually enabling of objectives in both the private sector and civil society, it is having some sovereign infrastructure that can be reliable and ideally governed by some guardrails or principles that we think are worth it. Because I think you can do that in an interim way through the procurement and investment process rather than having to wait for legislation to pass and everything to agree. Like, I think there's some lowest common denominator pieces that you could put out. I think the government is actually, in some cases, maybe already hinted they're looking to cover this because they recently, ICID, put out a request for information for large-scale sovereign AI data centers, and they had some criteria around those. We know this is a problem for companies. They can't, afford enough compute fast enough. So can we subsidize that? Could it be a licensed operator arrangement with compute that's already existing, but, spin it up in a way that is maybe subsidized for key startups, researchers? There maybe could be components that are spun off and air-gapped fully so that First Nations, Indigenous peoples can have kind of a basically a sovereign data center that is under their control with some ownership there. I think that could check some things off on accessibility, economic development, high-end research. And then also, let's say government has a portion of that. They kind of have an offtake agreement for a portion of that. let's say that operates under a bit of a higher level of scrutiny, and with more government kind of control, ownership, accountability. Well, then you can say, well, listen, actually, we're going to run some pilots that we think are going to improve efficiency and, three key areas of government work. And we're going to open it up, and, we're going to have kind of open, like we're going to try and take away the black box there and have some open algorithms and basically scrutiny to civil society. Like maybe this is trying to cover a few too many boxes, but like I think infrastructure can be a platform for a number of these things that we care about.
I did want to ask, the government used AI extensively to summarize both the expert reports and the survey results from the public. I thought, notably, all the data is out there. The expert reports are out there. The raw data from all the responses to the from the public are there as well. Do you see this happening a lot? Is this sort of like the new standard that you think we're going to have when it comes to public consultations, that essentially there's so much to read? There's a desire to move fast, and there'll be an increasing reliance on AI to try to summarize and identify some of these issues. And if that is the approach, what are some of the risks that you think we face by becoming more reliant on AI within that consultative process?
Definitely. Overall, I think it was a good idea that they did it. Guaranteed, it was an imperfect process. But as are probably most consultations, the reason I feel bullish about it, Michael, is because if using AI is a way for governments to do more consultations more rapidly and frequently, and possibly in a more transparent way, versus kind of pushing them off or maybe limiting the size of them because of capacity resources on the public service side, I think that is a good thing, right? Like ideally there are more frequent and effective public consultation cycles, opportunities that could be improved in the future. I mean, again, like if you're faster on the review process, maybe that means you give a bit more of an input window. Like again, maybe instead of 30 days, it's 60 or 90. I'm sure that would have maybe answered some of the concerns. I do think for some folks, there's probably no amount of consultation time that would have been sufficient, and no way the government could have done it that would have been positive. So I will just kind of call that out as well. At some point, you got to get something done. And so I think reasonable expectations, reasonable boundaries are good. I think some of the ways the government, maybe if they're going to start using AI for more consultations, I mean, there was a question I talked about the other day. It was, could they be more transparent about how it was used? Could they showcase some of the prompts? I don't know if they have to fully document the entire process. I think that's unrealistic and maybe even unfair. Because sometimes the government, you have to deal with some things that maybe like are necessary to do, but there's no way to make them look good. If you know what I mean, like dealing with outliers sometimes in consultations can be really, really hard. And you don't want to, have to put them on defense all the time. Otherwise, again, like if it is very hard to do governing, like I think people will resort to stuff that is less transparent. And so what I wonder about is there a balanced process that can be still highly effective and transparent and fast to create more confidence in the system? I think that would be a good outcome. So I think we'll see more of it, and I'm hopeful that it will continue to improve and the transparency will also be continue to escalate as people get more used to it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think there have been efforts to try to deal with some of the transparency. There's questions as to how some of the ongoing, even Treasury Board guidelines related to artificial intelligence use plays or what role it could play in these sorts of things. So let me ask you about this sense of consultation theater, which is, for me, has been sort of a term that I've used in a number of past consultations with government. And it speaks to this notion that government officials come in with some predetermined ideas, some predetermined framing of where they want to go. And so that runs the risk of turning a what we heard report into a more of what we wanted to hear report. You kind of come in advance knowing it, what it is that you want to hear, and you fit in what you got to meet that expectations. Do you think that was happening? And to the extent to which there is some of that, or you may have seen some of that in your time of government, thoughts on how we get out of a cycle where some of the consultation becomes a bit more of a legitimization process of some of the pre-existing thinking as opposed to a genuine effort to sort of gauge where the public is at and have that be the driver of policy.
And listen, like I will say this without trying to sound like a apologist, but I honestly think they did a pretty good job given the circumstances. Again, I've pointed out opportunities that I think they clearly could have done better, but I don't I think they clearly had a direction they wanted to go. But I mean, who doesn't? I mean, that's also why they were elected, right? They're elected in a current moment. They put a plan out. And that like that democratic input and the democratically elected members of parliament is also, I mean, that is a huge and important input. And so if they completely change their minds, I would have been very surprised. At the same time, I mean, I don't like what all those task force reports got published. Nothing was redacted. All of the raw data was published online. I think at the very least, that makes it very easy to compare and contrast. I mean, hey, like, here's what people said. Here's what ultimately came out in the report. And then again, we're still waiting for that final deliverable, which is the one that actually matters, which is the strategy. And then I would argue, also argue, actually, by the way, the budget coming in the spring after it. Though, like, I think those are the things to track. And then I would also further track, I mean, the implementation plan over the next 2 years. Like, I think that's really how you track whether it was consultation theater or not. I think it's way too early to determine that with a what we heard report like this, because again, these reports, I think they're important, but I've never thought to look too deeply into them themselves, because they are meant to draw consensus between people who don't always agree. And that is because they're trying to get to points of decision, strategic options that can be presented. So that's why I think it's still worth looking at the inputs that are behind. If they were doing consultation theater, they would probably have, appointed, honestly, people who would be even less critical or have less ambitious ideas. But I would say that there's very ambitious ideas from a lot of people, including, like, I know there's been criticism sometimes the composition from the task force is too business heavy, but to be clear, like, if some of those ideas are implemented from folks in the business community, there would be a massive revenue shortfall in possibly some areas of the government. It might require, billions and billions of dollars of investment, right? And that's, I'm sure, the minister seems to want to grow our AI companies and has expressed a preference toward lighter regulation, but I also know that they don't have unlimited money, and are under some significant fiscal constraints due to the financial situation of the country and the trade dispute right now. So yeah, like, if they wanted people who were just going to say exactly what they already wanted to do, I think the composition would have been different. That's the honest truth.
I think that's fair with respect to the panel. I guess my focus has been on what happens after once you get the data back from the panel or the public, and does it become is it massaged in such a way to sort of fit a particular narrative? But you're right, at the end of the day, I
Thank
suppose
you.
we'll wait to see what that actual outcome is. Why don't we close with this then? Speaking of outcomes, we've got this consultation, we've got the policy coming, the minister says in the first quarter, but let's assume sometime in the next few months or into the spring. You've already highlighted it. There have been change taking place globally. The Europeans have begun to shift. We've seen shift in the United States, and we have seen shifts in Canada in terms of what the minister has said, which is different from what prior ministers have said. And that leads to the sense that there are at least a couple of paths that may be conflicting, one with an emphasis on regulation and the risk of AI, and another with an emphasis on innovation and investment. I guess I would love your thoughts on whether they can be reconciled. How do we prioritize both of those key issues? And how do we ultimately make a real difference for Canada when it comes to both the development, adoption, and benefits that can come from AI, and at the same time address some of the concerns that people have with respect to potential harms?
100%. Listen, like, I can talk about the data, and I can also talk about some expert opinions here. Like, number one is, when we did a survey through the Public AI Awareness Working Group, with CIFAR, the kind of operators of the Pan-Canadian AI strategy, there was a survey that found 71% of Canadians at the time wanted appropriate risk regulation on AI. And Canada has one of the lowest levels of trust, our people, for AI systems. And so people are telling us they want some rules. That is, like, something to listen to, for business leaders and government leaders, right? So they're clearly not mutually exclusive if we want to drive, I think, better outcomes. I mean, China has one as almost the flip. Like, most of their citizens are very trusting of AI systems being integrated across the board. China also has lots of rules and, state direction on how this should be done or properly. I don't think we should copy their model, not, but I don't want that level of surveillance in our society. But I don't think we should just wait around to put some guardrails in. And again, lowest common denominator ones, like, do we know there is an AI system that is dealing with my data? Can you explain what it's doing, right? Like, these are things that I think almost anybody would want to know. I certainly would want to know if I was applying for a loan or my health data was being analyzed. I just want to be able to know that. The second thing I would say is, I think Dr. Taylor Owen put this quite well in his task force submission, but, smart regulation is not, I'm going to paraphrase it poorly, but it's basically not exclusive to economic development and growth. I believe that wholeheartedly. I do think some regulations, some rules can be good here. I don't think we should do nothing. Will they be reconciled in the short term? I don't think perfectly. I think what we're likely to see is some targeted bills, again, tackling some of the issues that we've talked about, sexually explicit deep fakes, likely some other online harms. We'll probably see some pieces in the updated privacy legislation that still deal with automated decision-making systems. And again, those would all advance the status quo. And bar none, I mean, Michael, you probably know this better than almost anyone in the country, like having good privacy rules will certainly help protect us from some of the excesses of AI that we're seeing now. And I think getting that done is probably step number one. This will be take three. Hopefully we can get a, maybe point three. We're not going to get a hat trick, but if we can get it on the third time, that would be great. And it will help all Canadians, no question. And I do think it will offer that long desired stability from businesses. It will allow them to plan better, structure the systems better, and it will have innovative applications, right? Number one, I think about open banking. We're seeing progress on that through other legislative elements, but and regulatory aspects. But again, like this helps. No question helps because there's a lot of financially related data or other data that banks and others may collect on you that you might just want to have accessible, portable. And the second thing is health innovation data. There's another piece of health legislation coming, but again, there's all these kind of interim, services that are kind of in the middle. Like there's a lot of layers around wellness and well-being, other things that I think are really important to people. So I think there's a lot of innovation that can be had there if we actually own our data. The last thing I'll just I have to put in a plug for this, but sovereign data trusts, actually leveraging Canada's data for Canada's benefit, would be a good thing. And I think good privacy legislation would make that more possible. And it can help us actually have, more and more ownership of our AI product services and our government, in terms of what's actually happening there. So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh no, I'm definitely glad you raised that last issue. It's an issue that I've talked about in the context of health data in particular and some of the
Yeah.
opportunities that we have and work that I've done with Kumin and Wilson that has really focused on some of those issues. Listen, you've been doing some really important work both in Ottawa and now back in Toronto when it comes to AI and privacy policy. And I'm grateful for that you've taken the time to come and talk about both that experience and where things may be headed in the future. So thanks so much for joining me here on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Michael, for your time.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.